So that's one thing to compare and contrast from the previous books or the surrounding books. Another one is worship. So if the book of Exodus ends with where God is to be worshipped at the tabernacle, the book of Leviticus tells the Israelites how God is to be worshipped at the tabernacle. So you've got the where and then the how in the next book. Another thing to compare and contrast from the surrounding books is this theme of access to God. In Genesis, after Adam and Eve sinned, and by the way, these notes are all going to be here for you guys if you want them afterwards. but in the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve are created, Adam is created outside of the garden. Have you ever noticed in Genesis 2 that he is created and then he's brought inside the garden? He's not created inside the garden. But he's brought into the garden where the presence of God is. And after Adam and Eve sin, what does God have as like his SEAL Team 6 to say you can't come back? The cherubim. So you've got access to God denied in Genesis 3:24. But then in the book of Exodus, you've got the tabernacle being built. But the problem after the tabernacle is built, this is where God is going to dwell, is that nobody can enter it now. Because his glory comes on the tabernacle. And this is like, okay, God's moving in. But now everybody's got to vacate his house because he's too glorious. So he's like moved closer to the Israelites, but there's still distance. Leviticus, you notice in Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1, that God is calling Moses from the tent of meeting. He's speaking to Moses from the tent. So you still have this distance that's happening. But in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, God is speaking in the tent to Moses. If you look at the beginning of Leviticus and you look at the beginning of Numbers, you've got this contrast where there's still this distance. God is speaking from the tent, but then in Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, God is speaking in the tent to Moses. So the difference then, why is it suddenly in the book of Numbers that there's more access to God? Because of the instructions of Leviticus and what they're teaching people how to do, draw near to God. And when you do these sacrifices, all these things that we're going to look at, then you can have this access to him. But it's only going to come through the offering. So you've got this theme of access to God running through the first four books of the Bible. And that's maybe one thing to say about its trajectory and how that works. Any comments or questions up to that point? Yes, we will talk about that. This shows us then when you look at how Leviticus begins, there's still this distance and then Numbers, how the distance has been closed in a little bit. Leviticus is showing you how to draw near to a holy God. That's what it was for the original audience. So when the classic joke is that whenever you're doing the Read the Bible in a Year program and you're like, oh, yeah, Leviticus is so boring. And then we think it's funny, but it's still God's word. So I don't know why we think that's funny. We should have the attitude that says God hasn't wasted any inspiration, ink or paper. So for the original audience of Leviticus, do you think that the instructions of this book would seem burdensome to them? Here's God, the holy God, that you guys have had to be distant from, and now he's moved into this house that you guys have built, the priest had to vacate because of all of his glory? Well, here's some instructions so that we can get that access more. I don't think this would have been a burdensome book to the original audience. This would have been a blessing to them. Because they would have wanted to draw near to him. And this book is showing them how to do that. One thing to say about this, apart from God telling them how they would draw near, there's no way they could have come up with their own system to do this. They need God to reveal this stuff to them so that they would know how to do it. One other thing here. All of the things that we're looking at, the offerings, tabernacle, priest, all the different kinds of offerings, all of these things are looking forward to Jesus. And so for us, therefore, the idea is that without Jesus, we don't know how to draw near to God. Without understanding these foreshadowings of Jesus, we have less of a picture of how we draw near to God and how this works in our life. So therefore, this book should not feel burdensome to us either. It should feel like a blessing because of what it's teaching us. Any comments or questions about any of that? All right, here's the outline chart that we'll look at for Leviticus. We'll see the concept of holiness. It's all throughout the book. We're not going to say so much about it today, but that is the major theme of the book, is that you should be holy because God is holy. But chapters 1 through 17 is showing you this is how you draw near to God. It's through these sacrifices. It's through these offerings. We'll talk about ritual purity and impurity when we get to those chapters. There's a lot of confusing things about those, a lot of befuddling things about them, and we'll talk about those as much as we will know how to when we get there. But chapters 1 through 17, this is the way that you approach God. It's through these bloody sacrifices, of which we'll talk about some today. This section can be subdivided. Chapters 1 through 7 talk about the five major offerings the Israelites would bring to God. Can anybody name the five offerings? I don't care what order they're in. Yeah. Okay, so those are the kinds of things that God would accept, but there's different kinds of offerings that could be any one of those kinds of animals. That probably didn't make sense, but it'll make sense in a little bit. Yeah. Okay, there's thank offerings, which get subdivided into three of the first five. Yeah. Yeah, burnt offering, sin offering, peace offering, grain offering, and there's a guilt offering. We're going to talk about the first three today, the burnt, the grain, and the peace offering. So that's chapters 1 through 7. Chapters 8 through 10 talk about the priesthood who are going to be officiating these sacrifices. And then chapters 11 through 17 talk about purity and atonement, all of these things that help people draw near to God. To be ritually impure, to be unclean, didn't mean that you were sinful. It meant that it was like you had the flu, you couldn't go to church or something like that. Like, you couldn't go to the temple because we'll talk about why that's the case. But all of these things are things that help people know how to draw near to God in the first 17 chapters. Okay, the second section, chapters 18 through 27, this is like the practical walk with God. What does my life look like when I'm in fellowship with Him? And there's things about sexual sin. There's things about not following the religious practices of the pagans. There's things about loving your neighbor. That's where these passages come from. Now, in Leviticus, there are only two stories. And you've got one story in each of these major sections. The first story is Nadab and Abihu, and it's in this overall section on how do I draw near to God, and you've got two people that don't properly draw near to God, and they're swiftly executed. The only other story in the book of Leviticus is this story in chapter 24, verses 10 through 23, where this kid, who would have been above the age of 12, by the way, blasphemes the name of God, and he's stoned. And so that story corresponds with your daily walk with God. You misuse God's name. You're not living the way He's asked you to live. Here are the consequences of it. So the two stories correspond to the overall sections that they're found in. Does that make sense? And they show you that God is going to take His laws seriously. When He says something, He means it. Okay. So they're at Mount Sinai for the totality of this book. Like we said, it covers the period of 1 month, and here are the two passages that you probably can't read from where you're sitting that show those time markers, that show in between that is where the book of Leviticus is found. Now, we'll see this chart more and more as we go through this, but any comments or questions about that? Cherry, did you have something? No, okay, all right. There's another way that the book of Leviticus can be structured, and it can be structured as chiasm. You guys know what that is? It's like the parallel pyramid kind of shaped structure. So here's another way to think about Leviticus. Chapters 1 through 7 talk about the rituals that they need to engage in to draw near to God. The end of the book, chapters 23 through 27, talk about rituals, but ones that are largely involved in their daily living. So you've got the book beginning and ending with rituals, and then you move into the priesthood in chapters 8 through 10 about like how they're ordinated and how they do their work in the temple and stuff like this. And then towards the end of the book, you've got moral laws for the priesthood, like who can they marry, who can they not marry, all this different sort of thing. And then you've got these ritual purity things going on in 11 through 15, but then you've got moral purity in 18 through 20. And at the very center of the book, anybody know what important day of the year it was that's emphasized in the two middle chapters of this book? Day of Atonement. By the way, the book of Leviticus is the middle book of the Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses. And in the middle of the middle book is the Day of Atonement. What's the Day of Atonement? Yes. Yes. By the way, that word atonement, what is it made up of? At one meant to be at one with God is kind of the idea again. You're communing with Him again. And all of these things, like the rituals, kind of like give you pictures of that, but it was done in a more complete way on the Day of Atonement once a year. So we'll talk about all of this as we go through this. Anything you guys want to say or ask about this parallel structure of the book? All right, so for today then, the outline of what we're looking at today. The first two verses give us the opening of Leviticus. There's a few things to say about that. And then chapter 1, verse 3 through 3:17 gives you the free will offerings. We'll talk about what I mean by that in a little bit. But then you've got the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offering, all of them being free will or thank offerings. So let's begin with the first two verses of the book and see what this has to tell us. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock." Okay, notice a couple things here. God is calling Moses. That same word for call is the one that's used in Exodus 3, verse 4, when Moses is at the burning bush and God calls him to the burning bush. So you can imagine God kind of calling Moses to this temple that you've got God's Shekinah glory on at the end of the book of Exodus. So there's a pattern, though, of God's glory coming on something and then God calling Moses. So he does that at Mount Sinai. Can you think of any other times where God's glory descends on something and then God calls specifically Moses? Okay, so maybe there's some parallels with Transfiguration, but in Exodus or Leviticus. The burning bush. It rhymes with Mount Sinai. Yeah, good, good, very good. So at Mount Sinai, God's glory comes on the mountain. And then God calls up specifically Moses. Here, he's doing the same thing at the tabernacle. God's glory has come at the tabernacle, and then God's calling specifically Moses. One observation from this, maybe you've seen a chart on this before, I don't know. But what this is showing us is that the tabernacle is becoming like a mobile Mount Sinai. Have you guys ever looked at a chart of the tabernacle where there's like three access points, kind of, or like there's the outer courts, there's the holy place, and then the most holy place. It's broken up into three places, each of which has more restrictive access. That's what Mount Sinai was like. You've got the camp of the Israelites at the base of Mount Sinai. That's like the outer courts, kind of, or maybe outside the outer courts. And then who gets to be brought up with the elders to one level? Moses and the leaders, that they're kind of functioning like the priests. And then who's the only one that can go all the way up to the top where God is? Moses. So what was experienced at Mount Sinai is being created to be a portable thing for the Israelites to move about wherever they want to in the wilderness, recreating that experience at Sinai. So that picture is kind of there for us. But here's God speaking to and through Moses from the tent. One interesting thing about Leviticus, there's no other book in the Bible that has more direct speech from God. Do we like what God says? Should we like Leviticus? We know the right answer to that. One of the phrases that you're going to see is God spoke to Moses saying, God spoke to Moses saying. It's all throughout the book of Leviticus. But notice that in verses 1 and 2 that Moses is supposed to relay this information to who? The sons of Israel. Now, one reason why I think this is important, or the people of Israel, does it say sons or people? Yeah, people of Israel, some versions might say son. So the people of Israel, have you ever thought before that Leviticus was mainly for the Levites? The beginning of the book says this is for all the Israelites. This information needs to be given and disseminated to all of the people. This is not just for the Levites so that they know how to do the things in the temple and all that kind of stuff. There's some of the things that are specifically applied to them. But this is a book that all of the people should need to know. And so that's the first part of the opening. But the other part at the end of verse 2, God gives this general statement about offerings. And he says, if you're offering, if you're going to offer something, make sure it's from the herd or the flock. And that sets up, in a lot of ways, the first 17 chapters about all these sacrifices that they need to make. Notice a couple things about that, though. The word offering in Hebrew is the word korban. Does that remind you of any passages in the New Testament, maybe? Yes. Yeah, that's where that word comes from, is this idea of Corbin that they misuse in Mark chapter 7. But this word for Corbin, it comes and it derives from a word meaning to come near. So embedded in the word offering is this concept of drawing near. Corbin relates to this idea. And so if you're offering, if you're coming near to God, it needs to come from the herd or the flock. What does that mean, that it needs to come from the herd or the flock? Where can't you find your offering that would draw you near to God? Can't be in the wild. Can it be Mr. Roadkill? It can't be roadkill that you happen upon. It's got to be an intentional offering that you make. This is setting us up for the first 17 chapters. All these offerings that God is going to want, it's not, it can't be like this lame or blind or crippled thing like what we see in Malachi. It's got to come by intention from your herd or your flock. And one lesson from that, which will be repeated as we go through these 17 chapters, is we don't give God our leftovers. Our study time, our prayer time, singing, we're not mumbling to God in our songs, lame and blind animals. God expects the offerings to not be roadkill. He is expecting it to be something that we're intentionally giving to him because that's what he's worthy of. All right. Anything you guys want to say about just the first two verses here? We won't go this slowly through every passage, but. All right. So imagine then the people are about, okay, that's kind of like the preamble to a lot of this book. Now the people are going, okay, like we want to draw near to God. Like this is not burdensome to us because we want to draw near to God. How do we do this, Moses? And so he's going to talk about these different offerings. Now this chart has a lot of stuff on it, as you can see. But the basic idea of this is that you've got the first three offerings here, the burnt, the grain, and the peace offering. Those are what you could call voluntary or thank you offerings because your gratitude towards what God has given you. There's different purposes, especially for the burnt offering. It seems like the most, it's the sacrifice that does the most. It's used in a lot of different kinds of contexts. But generally, these first three sacrifices are thank you offerings. And we'll talk about the details of these, but one thing I'll point out about the burnt offering is that everything is burnt except for the hide of the bull, which goes to the priests. And so I used to think that like even the skin was burned. It wasn't. That was the one thing that was actually left for the priests, because a lot of these sacrifices, in one way or another, would take care of the priesthood. And so I think I see Sewell coming in that back door over there, but I didn't unlock it. So, thanks, Stuart. Okay, that chart is available to you guys if you want that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. Let's just get into the burnt offering then. Okay, so look at Leviticus chapter 1, verses 3 through 9. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he shall kill the bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the wood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is on the entrance of the tent of meeting. Then he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces, and the sons of Aaron and the priests shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head, the fat, on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs shall he shall wash with water. And the priest shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering, with pleasing aroma to the Lord. Okay, so if you're going to do a burnt offering, you're going to see that there's different levels or different styles of burnt offering you can give. You can give a bull in verse 3. In verse 10, you could do a sheep or a goat. And then in verse 14, you could do birds. We'll talk about why there's differences there. But the reason I wanted to read all of the instructions for the bull is that the instructions for the other animals are more or less followed. And this is the one that's given the most detail, because you assume that after you know the details of the bull, you'd know how to do it with the lamb and the goat and all this kind of stuff. So what is said about the bull? It's got to be without blemish. And notice that if the offering is from the herd, which would be cattle, he's only accepting males here. It's not until you get to the peace offering that it can be male or female. So that's why I'm saying it's specifically a bull. If it's a burnt offering and it's a cattle, it's always going to be a male. So it's got to be without blemish, which means that God wanted the animals with the greatest economic value, that God comes first in the things that you're giving to him. Like we know before, Malachi, they're giving them like the leftovers, the ones that nobody wants, the lame, the blind, the crippled ones, and they're denounced for that. But what's the purpose of this offering according to this passage? Yeah. In verses 3 and 4, it's to be accepted, it's to make atonement. Now, there's the sin and the guilt offerings, which also deal with sin. So I take this to mean that it's like the general acceptance that I am an unholy person trying to come before a holy God. And so even though this is a free will offering, it's still embedded in this is the acknowledgement that I am a sinful person. It's also offered as a pleasing aroma to God. You've got this picture of God kind of smelling it, and it's something that is very pleasing to him. And I think we'll say more about that in the coming weeks, because this phrase is used a lot in the book of Leviticus. I want to focus, though, on the procedure here. One of the things that I hadn't given a lot of appreciation to is in the procedure, who's doing most of the work? The person offering the sacrifice. Now, the priests are involved too. But whenever you see in this passage where it says, he shall, he shall, he shall, this is talking about what the offerer does. So the offerer brings the bull to the tabernacle, puts the hand on the head of the animal. Now, why does he put the hand on the head of the animal? Sometimes people have said that it's the transference of sin, that I'm acknowledging my sin, but it's going on this animal. Not so with the burnt offering. There's only one sacrifice in Leviticus where people explicitly confess their sins over the animal. Anybody know what sacrifice that is? Nope, it's not even the sin offering, actually. Nope. It's not one of the five ones. It's on the Day of Atonement. The goat that sacrificed, that is the only animal in Leviticus, in the whole sacrificial system, where somebody lays, I think it's both their hands on the animal, and then they confess their sins on the animal, on the scapegoat, and then it runs away. For them to lay their hand on the animal, I do not think for the burnt offering or any of the first five offerings, that it's for the transference of sin. I think that's for the Day of Atonement. So I think what's happening here is like touching them on the head is like owning the effect of sin. It's like knowing like this thing has to die because of what I did is more so the idea. They bring it to the tabernacle, lay their head on it. They kill the bull. How would they kill the bull? They would slit the throat. Okay. One thing that I want to point out about this that I think helps us. So there's other passages in the Bible that talk about the book of Moses, singular, or the law of Moses, singular. Which books are referred to as the law of Moses? First five books of the Bible. Which means, therefore, in my understanding of this, that when you're reading Genesis and you read about a burnt offering, I think Leviticus is codifying what they were doing in Genesis. And so when you read about a burnt offering in Genesis, I think these are the instructions for the burnt offering. These are the same things that they would have been doing, minus the priesthood, because it would have been the patriarchs doing it. But it's the same process. Now, the reason why I think that's interesting is because when Abraham was going to offer up Isaac as a burnt offering, I think these are the instructions. I think this is what he was going to do. Which means, if you've ever seen a depiction of Abraham offering up Isaac, how is Abraham normally holding the knife? Do you think the offer, when they go to they bring the sacrifice to the priest, and they put the hand on it, okay, and the priest goes, all right, kill it. And you're like, do you think that's what they were doing? That's not the picture of what Abraham was about to do. It's more intimate than that. It's up to the neck. They slit the throat. If you've ever looked up a YouTube video, by the way, of Muslims offering sacrifices, it's the same, in some ways, somewhat similar. If you've got the gut for it, I'd recommend looking up a video of it. And so they slit the throat, and then they cut the animal in pieces after it would have bled out, and they wash the entrails and the legs, where the dung would be. So they're cleaning all of that off. They're washing the filth off of the sacrifice. Here is the offerer doing this. Now, we look at this. We're not used to, all of our, you know, the chicken that you ate yesterday? Do you know how it was killed? Or the steak or whatever you had? I don't want to know. But in the ancient world, this stuff was just more, people were just accustomed to butcher shops. We've been kind of overly, desensitized is the wrong word. We've been not sensitized at all to this stuff or something. I don't know how you think about that. We're just not used to watching things die, like animals and stuff. All of this is just done for us, and then we pay for it, and then we're good. The offerer. So when daddy leaves the house to go bring a bull to the priesthood, and the kids go, hey, daddy, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to give this to God. Do you suppose that the father was happy about his ability to give something to God? Yeah, but he had to go through this process, though. So he's doing all this stuff. The offerer is doing this. And then at the same time, the priest, and you know what the priest is doing, where it says, the sons of Aaron shall. So you've got these interlocking instructions for the offerer and the priest. And what the priest does is he's going to throw the blood on the altar. So the blood is going to drain. He's going to get it in a basin or something like that. He's going to throw it on the altar. He's going to put wood and fire on the altar. So he's going to get the wood that's going to help consume the offering. He's going to put that down, and then he's going to arrange the sacrifice on top of the wood, and then it's going to be burnt up, everything except for the hide. Yeah, Jerry? Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes. So it's not just the priesthood getting bloodied up here. And doesn't the New Testament talk about, in a sense, dying with Jesus, contacting his blood, kind of the imagery in Romans 6? To make these offerings and to draw near to God, you're going to get bloody too. There's going to be the death of all kinds of things going on here. So that's the procedure generally. Anything else you guys want to say about that one? That if you slit it, it splatters everywhere. Okay, yeah, I'm not sure. I take it that they were slitting the throat though, and that it was getting everywhere. It wasn't a clean business, I would guess. Yeah, and you start to see why do you have the bronze laver, the laver for washing? like, well, you see, you got to clean the dung off of the entrails and the legs and stuff like this for it to be an acceptable offering to God. So you're doing all this very intricate work. All right, so that's the instruction for the bull. Now, I want to talk about the sheep and the goats, and then the birds, and then make some overall observations from this. So in verses 10 through 13, you've got the sheep and the goats. We're not going to read this. But a couple things to point out about this is that, do you remember the daily offerings that were offered at the tabernacle in the morning and at nighttime at 3 o'clock, at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is the same time period that Jesus was on the cross, by the way. So when Jesus was put on the cross, that was the time of the morning sacrifice. When he breathed his last breath, that would have been the time of the evening sacrifice. And so the daily offerings that were made at the tabernacle and the temple, they were the lamb variety of the burnt offering, not the bull variety. So every day at the temple, they're offering two burnt offerings that were sheep or goats, or specifically sheep. And those are the passages for that. Okay. One other thing about the sheep and the goats is that it's killed on the north side of the altar. I assume that maybe the bull was also killed on the north side of the altar, but you get a new detail here. Why on the north side of the altar? I don't know. Maybe because the ashes are already on the east side of the altar in verse 16. Seems to be the idea, at least for the bird offerings. The laver was already on the west side, so maybe it's just a practical reason that you kill them on the north side of the altar. That's where you kill them. So, all right, and then you got the birds. Anybody know why you could bring a bird offering? Financial. So in Leviticus 12, verse 8, if you couldn't afford the more expensive varieties, you could do the bird. By the way, guess whose family had to offer a bird offering at the dedication of their son? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus' family had to, which means that Jesus probably came from a poor family. And one lesson we learn from this is that God welcomes people from all economic statuses. You don't have to have a certain amount of wealth. You shouldn't expect a certain kind of amount of wealth after you start serving God. These people are still serving God, and what they still have are birds to offer. So that's one thing to say about that. The procedure changes a little bit for a bird because it's small. So the priest kills the bird by wringing its neck off. So like if the offerer killed the other animals, like how are you going to slit the throat of like a pigeon or a turtle dove or something? Like the priestess takes it and goes, okay, boom, and then lets the blood drain directly onto the side of the altar. There's no collecting the blood or splashing it. It's just kind of like almost like opening up a soda can and like, I don't know, with the blood. You won't forget it now. Okay, so a couple of like reflections on the burnt offering. God was not expecting worshipers to be passive spectators. When we come and we assemble on Sundays, can we have like a spectator kind of passivity about us with the songs that we sing? Are we opening our Bible to the passages that we're looking at? Are we distracted on our phones? Are we engaged? God expected it's not like the offer could like get up out of bed, just like, okay, I'm going to bring the bull. All right, there you go, priest. Like, do your work. I'm just going to sit back and watch. No, you actually had to be involved in it. And so that's one thing that I learned from that. With the burnt offering being totally consumed except for the hide, you give everything to God. In Romans 12, that imagery is used for us that we're living sacrifices. Everything we have belongs to God. We're supposed to dedicate everything to Him. But Jesus is ultimately the one that was without blemish that gave Himself for us first. And so He became a burnt offering in that sense for us. But as we'll see, Jesus is pictured in every one of these sacrifices. It's no single sacrifice can fully adequately explain what Jesus has done for us. All right, so that's the burnt offering. Any comments or questions on that one? All right, we move to the grain offering then. So we go from Abel's offering to Cain's offering. God was accepting of both kinds of offering. But here's the grain offering. And there's a couple things to say about this one. There's different varieties of grain offerings. But one of the purposes of the grain offerings is it accompanied the same purpose as the burnt offering. So if you brought a burnt offering, you were likely also going to bring a grain offering. And whatever reason you were bringing the burnt offering, if it was for thankfulness to God, if it was for the dedication of a temple, if it was for some kind of rejoicing celebration or something like that, you'd also bring grain offerings that kind of mirrored and mimicked the reason that you brought the burnt offering. And so there's some passages there that show that. But there are different varieties of these grain offerings. You can have an uncooked one in verses 1 through 3. And the ingredients for these is fine flour, oil, and frankincense. And the instructions for how you bring this is you bring the offering to the priests. The frankincense is all offered to God. It's all burned. It's not baked into the bread. But then there's a memorial portion. So if you have an uncooked grain offering, the priest would take a scoop of it, and that would be the memorial portion that would be burned up to God. And then where would the rest of the grain offering go? To the priests. The rest would go to them. Numbers 18 talks about that, and so they would eat it at in that location. But then you can also have grain offerings that are of the cooked variety. So look at verses 4 through 10. When you bring a grain offering baked in the oven as an offering, it shall be unleavened loaves of fine flour mixed with oil or unleavened wafers smeared with oil. And if your offering is a grain offering baked on a griddle, it shall be a fine flour unleavened mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. And if your offering is a grain offering cooked in a pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. And you shall bring the grain offering that is made of these things to the Lord. When it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar, and the priest shall take from the grain offering its memorial portion and burn this on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is a most holy part of the Lord's food offerings. Okay. What are the three ways that you could cook it? One of them was on a griddle. I would guess that one was pretty good, but there's one that might taste even better. Yeah, fried in a pan. That would be a good one. So you got baked in an oven, cooked on a griddle, or fried in a pan. I don't know the answer to this. Why do you think God is accepting of different varieties of grain offerings? I just feel like there's something to that question, but I don't know what the answer is. Maybe not everybody had a griddle. Maybe it's kind of like the dove thing, the bird thing, where it's like, you know, maybe you don't have the newest oven. Maybe when you entered the promised land and the house that you took, maybe like, oh, rats, it didn't have an oven, but we got these griddles or something. And so maybe like that was for like the richer people. I don't know. Maybe that is part of it. Any other thoughts, Cherry? That makes sense. Yeah. So maybe the deep fried one wouldn't be the best one. If any other thoughts on that? Yeah. Yes. Yes, and there's a lot of detail, like the fine flour, like God is wanting detailed kind of work to bring these things to him. Men or women in the ancient world, who's going to be more in charge of the cattle and the herd and everything? Men. Generally, who's going to be more the one cooking? Women. Maybe that's part of it too. I don't know. But the man would get the food from the field. And then who's going to be the one that's going to prepare it in the house? Maybe this is part of the way that women could be involved in these sacrifices as well. I don't know. Were you going to say something? Yeah, so part of this is going to God. Part of it is going to the priests. But if there's like the traveling aspect to get to the temple, like let's say it takes you a week to get to the temple and you had to prepare it before you left home, and then they've got 3 days. So the bread at that point is 10 days old, but it's like 3 days after they receive it. So if there's extra time leading up to when they would give it to them would be the idea, maybe, though. All right, so, yeah. Yes. Yeah, like how do you make fine flour? What kind of work does it take to do that? I don't know, because I'm a man. Yeah, the mortar. How do you make fine flour? Yeah, I've heard that you have to crush it and stuff. And it takes a lot of work to, like, work out all the harsher parts of the flour. And so, like, before it can be accepted to God, it has to be made into fine flour. Maybe there's lessons with that. So, can offerings to God, can people that are devoted to God come in different kind of shapes and varieties, and like everybody's kind of got their gift and their talent? Maybe this is an accommodation for the different things that people had in their homes, that God is wanting everybody to be able to bring something. Yeah. Or, no. Okay. All right. Then the third kind is the first fruits. These would be like at the beginning of the barley or the wheat seasons. This is just dedicating to God, anticipation of more of the harvest. We'll talk more about that when we get to Leviticus 23 and 21. But part goes to the priests. So the memorial portion, when you think about the grain offerings, the memorial portion is what goes to God. The rest of it goes to the priests. We'll come back to that in just a moment, but there's some supplemental instructions about the grain offerings I want to read. Look at verses 11 through 13. No grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any honey as a food offering to the Lord. As an offering of first fruits, you may bring them to the Lord, but they shall not be offered on the altar for a pleasing aroma. You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering with all the offerings that you offer with salt. Okay, so with these supplemental instructions here, you have to make sure that you, when you bring these offerings, it's got to be without honey and without leaven. Now, what's the reason for the leaven? That's the easier one to answer. What was that? Okay, yeah, so the leaven makes... Yeah, has the leavening effect. How is that pictured in the Bible? What is that a metaphor for in the Bible? Sin, yeah. So, it's a symbol for sin in several different places, yeah. That's true. It would make it look bigger than what it really is. So, like, would that be like an Ananias and Sapphira sort of thing? That's a good point. I never thought about that. It's kind of like a blowfish. Like, look at the big offering. No. Like, let's get the air out of it. That's actually what it is. Okay, good. So, without the honey and leaven, but why no honey? I don't know. But here's what some people have speculated, that honey was possibly used in pagan rituals at temples, which if that is the case, there's other people that have said, like, honey is the glory of man in Proverbs 26, whatever that means, I don't know. You don't have to do a lot of work for honey. Like, you just find it, and then you, like, don't let the bees sting you, but it's, like, already made. And maybe, like, God is wanting something that involves more work. I don't know. Jerry? Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, it's got to be certain stuff in it that's only for God. It would not be, it's preventing the leftovers, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Good. If this is because of pagan rituals, which apparently some historians have found that pagans did some things with honey in the temple as part of their sacrifices, this would introduce a theme in Leviticus where many of the instructions are given out of a reaction to what the pagans did. Like, how many of you have gotten so mad lately that you're like, ooh, I could just boil a goat in its mother's milk? That instruction is given in Leviticus. Anybody just really had the urge to do that? Well, why would anybody have the urge to do that back then? Because that's what the pagans did. And so it's saying, don't be like them. Maybe the no honey thing is like that. Okay, so no honey, no leaven, but with salt. Salt is a thing that's a preservative, And it's talking about the salt of the covenant is the term that it's using here, is that when you bring salt on the offerings, on the grain offerings, it's a way of reminding you that God's not going to leave you or forsake you. It's a way that you're keeping your covenant with God. Jesus says in the New Testament, we are the sacrificial salt of the earth, that we've got this covenant with God that's permanent with him, and we're trying to help other people come to know about this as we try to preserve the dying world, is kind of the imagery there. Okay, a couple of reflections on the grain offering. We give back to God from the work of our hands. The fine flour, the work of getting the frankincense, the oil, the pressing of the olives to get the oil, like all of this work that we do, all of the stuff that we do to take care of our family, God gets some of that work that we do. That's where the grain would have come from. God is worthy of detailed attention. Like all of this work that it would take, like you've got the different baking options and all this kind of stuff. Can you imagine, like, whenever they get home, maybe they had like a printout, which they couldn't have done because they didn't have printers back then. But if they had a printout by their oven and it said, like, remember, wife, these are the ways that you can get these things prepared or whatever. Like, when Deuteronomy talks about having the law of God written on the doorposts and stuff like that, what would some of those laws have been? Like, some of these things that were incorporated into the way that they cook and what they cook and all these things. God's worthy of all kinds of attention and detailed attention. And then thirdly, Jesus is pictured as grain that dies in John chapter 12. He's pictured as this piece of grain that has to die and go into the ground, and then he sprouts up a new person. Maybe there's some connection to there. I don't know. Anything you guys want to say about the grain offerings? Okay, then we move to the peace offerings. So the instructions for these, we're not going to read all of this, but the purpose of the grain offering, of the peace offering, this is a celebration of peace with God. We'll see how this works more in just a second. But it also functions as a fellowship or a covenant meal where the priest would have some of this, and the people offering it would have some of this as this peace fellowship kind of covenantal meal. The things that could be offered here would be a herd from the herd, which would be cattle, so bull or cow, or it could be from the flock, which would be sheep or goats. What's missing here from the burnt offering? Birds, because you can't eat. There's not enough meat in a bird for everybody to share a meal. I think that's probably the idea of that. But the procedure of this is similar to the burnt offering. You present the animal to the priest. You lay your hands on the head. You slaughter it. The blood is thrown on the sides of the altar. But there's only parts of it that are burned because parts of it are going to be eaten. So the fat, the kidneys, the lobe of the liver are burned. And it says in verse 5, on top of the burnt offering. Notice how it says this in Leviticus chapter 3, verse 5. Yeah, so like with the burnt offering, where like everything's going to God except for the hide and for the dung, where you clean out the entrails. So you got the wood prepared, and on top of that wood, you've got the burnt offering. And then if you were bringing a peace offering at the same time, the peace offering would just go right on top of the other stuff and all be burned together. Or maybe the burnt offering would be burnt first, and then this would go on top of the ashes. I think it's more like everything went on top of each other. Look at chapter 3, verse 5. Then Aaron's son shall burn it on the altar on top of the burnt offering, which is on the wood on the fire. It is a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Have you ever noticed that before? Isn't that cool? Well, what's the point of that? What observation can we make from that? You can't have a peace offering until you've done what first? Made atonement. So how does fellowship come? After you've dealt with sin. So an Israelite, like, what if an Israelite was like, okay, I just was really mean to my wife and kids, but I'm going to bring this lamb as my peace offering. What would the priest have to say? Do you have a burnt offering first? I don't know if they always had to go together, but you can imagine that there'd be times where that might be a question. Because the order of this is one goes on top of the other. By the way, in verse 9, it talks about some sheep that you have to remove the fat because the fat goes to God. It talks about the whole fat tail. There's some sheep that apparently had extra fatty tails or something like that. And those would have been the ones presumably used for the peace offerings because the fat goes to God. Notice a couple things, though. The differences from the burnt offering, the offerers and the priests ate of this one, but not the other with the burnt offering. No birds are allowed, too small to create a meal, I think is the reason. And in this one, the peace offering can be male or female, for whatever that's worth. Okay. Look at verse 6, the last verse of this chapter, though. Look at the prohibitions that are given at the end. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places that you eat neither fat nor blood. All right. So, no eating blood. Why? I think, yes, I think it was used in pagan rituals. Any other reasons for this? Yeah, life is in the blood. Leviticus 17, verse 11 will say this, that there's something sacred and should be honored about the blood. If you're going to kill an animal, you drain the blood, but you don't consume it. You just took its life from it, so you don't drink that. This is also taught in the New Testament, by the way. I know that there's some countries that have blood sausage. If somebody kills their first deer, they will sometimes drink the blood from the deer. I don't think those are things that Christians should be doing. I don't think this is just an Old Testament thing. I think this is something that transcends every covenant that God has made. So no eating the blood, but for a very different reason, what else can't you eat? Fat. So it's hard to be keto and a Jewish person, if you know what the keto diet is. Everybody in California would have laughed at that because they know what it is. Okay, so no eating the fat. This belongs to God. It's pictured as the best part of the animal. The best goes to God, kind of like the first fruit kind of picture. But this instruction is given, it says in verse 17, in all your dwellings. What would that mean? Yeah. Where might they end up living where eating blood or eating fat might be especially tempting? Okay. What about exile? I wonder when Daniel the prophet is refusing to eat the food. We don't get all the details on what he's refusing to eat or what all the reasons are. But when you start to look at some of these instructions that were given about what you could and couldn't eat, there's a lot of these kinds of things. That'd be the first command in the Bible is don't eat something. And then there's a lot of laws in the Leviticus or Exodus about what you can and can't eat too and stuff like this. So maybe some of that was informing Daniel. So some final reflections just on the peace offering. We've talked about this already, but the death of an animal brings peace. The death of Jesus brings peace to us. But maybe something else to say about this, and this kind of summarizes some things even from the grain offering, is that our worship to God can also have a benefit to other people. Because when they would bring a grain offering, who else got to eat the grain offering? The priest did. Do you suppose that if there was ever some dude that would come to the tabernacle or the temple and be like, oh man, it's Cadmeel. He's coming again. Look at it, it's Cadmeel. His wife always does the deep fried bread. Like, you got to imagine that they had like funny conversations like this. Like, this was part of their culture. And like, they would have had like their favorite cook people or whatever that brought their offerings and stuff. Or like, if they heard that so-and-so got a new oven at their house, like, oh, we're really excited for that one to come. Like, as we look at these instructions, imagine what this would have looked like in their social life. I think this is one of the reasons why we don't memorize things like Leviticus. We don't think, like, what would this have been like for, how would these laws have affected the way they had conversations with each other and the jokes that they would have even made, you know. But the point in this last idea here is that when they cared about worshiping God, it had the collateral effect of blessing other people. When we care about God above everything else, in what ways does our devotion to God help other people? That's a question, by the way. What do you guys think? Yeah. Good. What else? Yeah. like the girl that taught me the gospel, like she had a different kind of demeanor than in anybody else I'd ever seen. I'm like, well, there's something she has that I don't have, and I want to learn about that. But it's because she loves God. So what else? Yes. Right. Yeah. It's like the really good friends of ours in Tennessee, they had a son that was 19 months old and he drowned. We've been there 3 times in the last year just to visit them. They're just really good friends of ours. And the way that it went all over Facebook, where the husband wrote something called Only Forward, like how they're processing the death of their kid. And like God was at the center of everything. They weren't bringing all this. Like everybody was kind of wanting to know how they felt about what was going on. Like they wanted to hear them speak. And so they weren't bringing like undue attention to themselves, but they, in a very tactful, helpful way, talked about how God is helping them with everything. And so their devotion to God comforted everybody else that was heartbroken over Isaac's death. I think even like about the financial offerings, like how many preachers are supported at this church when we are giving back to God, but where does the money go? To preachers of the gospel is a lot of where that goes to. So like that's your worship to God, right? But it's helping other people. So love God, love others. These are two instructions that can't be separated. A lot of the times when we put God first, there's some kind of ripple effect, or there's some kind of direct effect where it is helping somebody. And you just wonder, like, when these people are preparing all these sacrifices and stuff, they're thinking, yeah, we're going to give this to God, but I hope that that new high priest really likes the way that she just made that, you know? Or he. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? No. Nope. That's all God's. So can you think of any priests that tried to take, or that they did take the fat from the sacrifices? Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They were taking their Triton and plunging it into the fat and eating it and like threatening the people to say like, no, 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 like back away, this is mine. What if the grain was fried? Oh, I think it would have been fried like an oil. Yeah. Good. All right, anything else? All right, so Lord willing, in 2 weeks, I don't know yet if we're going to do chapters just 4 and 5, or if we'll do like 4 through 7, because that concludes the section. We might highlight a couple things after we talk about the sin offering and the guilt offering, because the rest of it after that is like, here's the extra instructions specifically for the priests, and I think we can probably just highlight some of those things, and then we'll get into the ordination of the priest, and then getting to Nadab and Abihu. So, all right, this is a good place to stop. Then we're already a little past time. I'll go ahead and pray for us. Gracious Father, we're so thankful to you that you are willing to accept offerings from us, but we know that it's only possible because Jesus first offered himself for us. Lord, we pray that we would desire to know the things that this book says, that we would understand that your word is not burdensome, but your word is intended to be a blessing. Your word is intended to help us know you and know how to draw near to you and know what's required to draw near to you. And Father, we're reminded this morning that it takes the bloody sacrifice of a spotless Lamb of God to let us come near to you. We thank you so much that Jesus was that offering for us. We pray that in response to his offering, that we would in turn, offer ourselves back to you as a living sacrifice. We thank you so much for your son, and we thank you for the hope that he gives us, and it's in his name we pray. Amen.